This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 122 was recorded on June 14th, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. With the OPEC meeting coming up next Friday and big announcements today in the oil market, it's time for a crude oil special on Macro Voices, and we've got a really fantastic one lined up for you this week. We're going to start with a short interview with Dr. Ellen Wald, whose new book, Saudi Inc., has been the talk of the town among energy traders. Ellen will give us some perspective on Saudi Arabia from the Saudi perspective, including what caused them not to support prices in the fall of 2014. Then I'll be speaking in depth with Joe McMonagle and Anas Al-Haji about what we can expect from next week's OPEC meeting and beyond. Joe heads up the Energy Policy and Geopolitics Group at Hedgeye in Washington, D.C., and Anas is an independent energy consultant based in Dallas who will be speaking to us this week from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. We're excited also to announce that we've decided to move ahead with our first Macro Voices live event in Toronto on August 10th, featuring Luke Groman, Jeff Snyder, and a number of other speakers. We'll have a detailed announcement about that and instructions for how to register after the market wrap before our feature interviews begin.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, we had three central banks within 24 hours with the Fed, the ECB, and the Bank of Japan. And I would have thought initially that the stock market would have had a much bigger reaction just because there's so much big news. And here we find ourselves, the S&P 500, just a stone's throw away from 2,800 again. It's almost like nothing is moving this market. Is this going to keep pushing higher in your mind?
You know, I think that it probably will, as we've been discussing on the last several shows. The big question is to what end? How far? And at this point, you know, I don't really see very much enthusiasm in this market. I would be surprised if a summer rally took us to new all-time highs. But I was actually very curious to hear Paul Tudor Jones interviewed on CNBC this week. Paul Tudor Jones doesn't give a lot of interviews. He's a very famous macro commodities trader. And he said he thinks that actually it'll probably be a lazy summer, but then toward the end of the year, he thinks a move up in stocks is likely toward the end of the year. Now, he still thinks it's a setup. He thinks it's akin to 1987, but he sees the end of the year as a time we might see a big move up in equity markets, where a lot of people are seeing the second half of the year, particularly after Labor Day, is when we might see a continuation to the downside. So a lot of interesting views out there. It'll be very interesting to see how this plays out. The Russell hit new all-time highs this week. You know, can the S&P get to new all-time highs? I suppose anything is possible. So bottom line, Patrick, my perspective is we're somewhere between the beginning of the end and the middle of the end. I don't think we're at the end of this bull market. I think we're somewhere between the beginning of the end and the middle of the end. And it's very hard to know exactly how that's going to play out. I do feel like we're in a topping process. The question is just how high can it go before it's finally over, and what's it going to look like after that?
Eric, let's move on to that U.S. dollar index, because what a move we saw after the ECB and Mario Draghi. We first initially saw the U.S. dollar continue its weakening after the Fed, but we ripped basically from being around 93 and a quarter to almost being back to 95 on that dollar index, all within the one trading day. I mean, this is a legit dollar index breakout, and it's interesting because it's the euro breaking down that's the momentum, but when you go to the emerging markets, I mean, there's still so many stresses in so many of these emerging market currencies. That dollar doesn't seem to let up. What's your take here?
Well, you know, we've heard so many really smart people explain with very, very intelligent arguments why the dollar is about to crash. But look at this chart. And, you know, it is certainly on a day like today, a big news day, it's very easy to say, okay, maybe this was that sort of knee-jerk reaction. We need to see it move above 95, and we need to see a daily close above 95 to really cement the deal here. But I think this is a legit move. Yes, it's in reaction to policy announcements, but it hasn't started to retrace as of the end of the day. We're talking just after 4 p.m. on Thursday, and we're still looking at, 94.77, almost on the high of the day. This looks legit to me. So I think the jury is still out, and we'll see what happens.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because obviously we're going to have a whole series of guests here talking about this. But what's your thinking here on oil into these interviews?
Well, what I'd like to do is save most of this for our feature guests, because they're the experts here. However, there are some things that happened after these interviews were taped that our guests didn't know about. So I want to make sure the audience is aware of what the guests were not aware of, so that you can put their comments into perspective. Inventory, we had the API report, which expected a build on inventory before we taped this interview. But then after we taped the interview, DOE came in with a massive drawdown of 4.1 million barrels of crude oil, Cushing drawing down 687,000 barrels, gasoline drawing down 2.3 million barrels, distillates drawing down 2.1 million barrels. Now remember, the news of the 2.2 million barrel build on distillate inventory last week was big news. Well, it's all been wiped out this week. So all of these things, needless to say, are very bullish for oil prices. Massive drawdowns in inventory, much larger than expected. But there was also very bearish news. Production spiking up another 100,000 barrels per day. Now 100,000 barrels per day added to production annualizes to about 5 million barrels per year. Now, obviously, I don't think that we're going to see 5 million barrels of additional production this year, but the year's less than half over, and we're more than a million barrels ahead of last year. So 10.9 million barrels of U.S. production, new all-time record, and it just keeps on building. So I think this trend is really important to keep an eye on. Needless to say, there was a very significant spike in oil prices to the upside in reaction to this, and traded along after that, kind of edging up. But then we got some really big news on Thursday morning after all of three of these interviews had been taped, which is both Russia and Saudi Arabia came out with statements saying it is inevitable. They don't know the exact outcome of the meeting next week. Needless to say, they've got to have their meeting. But they're setting expectations in the marketplace that it is inevitable that there will be some kind of increase in production. And by the way, folks, on the week that they originally announced this production cut deal, our comments here on Macro Voices were predicting exactly this outcome. What I said on this program was they're just saying that they are doing this until December with a caveat that they might change it in June. What it really means is the production cuts are until June and they're going to reevaluate it then. And that's really what's happening. So we knew this all along, but it's a change in market perception. At this point, you would think that that would really, really cause a big sell-off. I was surprised, actually. There was, needless to say, a big knee-jerk down on those announcements coming out this morning, but it was less than a dollar of downside, and it's almost fully retraced by the end of the day. So it feels like the market really is pretty strong here, and even this expectation-setting lip service coming from both Saudi Arabia and Russia saying, expect there to be increases of production out of OPEC and Russia at the OPEC meeting next week. The downside that came out of that announcement has almost completely retraced out of the market. So those are the things that have happened since these interviews were taped. Let's leave the rest of the commentary on oil for our feature interview guests.
All right, well, let's move on to gold because, you know, if you just told me that the dollar index was going to rip back to 95 in one day and asked me what I thought gold was going to be doing, I thought it would have been well under 1300 on the downside. And yet today, gold is up the same time as the dollar index is up. Now, one day doesn't make a new trend, nor does it decouple the intermarket relationship. But it is interesting that gold, at least initially, is very non-responsive to that. What's your take here on gold?
Well, Patrick, not only do I agree with what you said, but if you look at where we were on just Wednesday morning, you know, yesterday morning, as we're taping this on Thursday afternoon, we were unable to hold on to that 1300 round. We were starting to trade down as low as 1295. Really looked like gold was headed south. Well, that was yesterday morning. Now, in the face of this massive upside move in the dollar, we tested as high as 13.12 this afternoon, back down to about 13.06 as we're recording here. And as you say, Patrick, this correlation change where we're seeing gold strong even on a really strong U.S. dollar index day against the euro is absolutely fascinating. You know, for a while, we were talking to Raul Paul and some other guests about the possibility of gold and the dollar both moving up in unison together. And a few people, including Raul, had that theory a couple of years ago. Seems like it didn't play out. Maybe it's starting to play out now.
Now, Eric, I want to move on to this 10-year Treasury yields, because here we had obviously headlines like Jeffrey Gundlach saying over the next 3 years, the 10-year yields heading up to like 6%. But yet some big trader, I attached the article in our research roundup so our listeners can actually read the article. But some traders have been putting on massive bets with call options on Treasury bonds rising, which is yields declining on that 10-year, to the tune of 200,000 call options, some $75 million that they put on, betting that the yields over the next month or two are heading down to the 2.6 area on the 10-year. Wow, is all I have to say. This is going to be the most entertaining summer in terms of yields, in terms of seeing how this plays out and whether this gamble plays out. How does that kind of jive with the way you're looking at the 10-year yield? Here.
Well, I saw that story, and I guess, you know, it's so easy to jump to that conclusion that somebody has placed this massive, massive bet, a speculation that we're going below 2.60. Those calls are going to come into the money at that strike price, and somebody thinks they're going to make a fortune. You know, that's the thing that is kind of intuitively obvious to speculate. Someone might be speculating. But what if it's not a speculation, Patrick? What if it's a hedge? What if somebody has put on outright futures in that same size, which is beyond huge? That's really, really big institutional money going short treasuries in the futures, not in the options. And they're buying that protective call to hedge them against the risk of a move that goes beyond that. How do we know what somebody's motivation was if we can't see the rest of their balance sheet and we don't know who they are? So if it really was a speculative bet, and I don't know if you've seen any analysis that causes one to conclude that it was a speculative option trade. Most people I know that are speculators don't have $75 million to lay down on buying calls on a speculation that something pretty crazy is going to happen. It sounds to me more like a really, really big institutional hedge transaction against a short position in futures.
Eric, absolutely. It's going to be very interesting to see how this all plays out. I mean, even if it is a hedge, someone is spending the money to hedge their, let's say, short treasury position to that $75 million tune. And you wouldn't spend that money unless you thought there was a legitimate risk that needed to be hedged. So whether it is for speculation or whether it is for hedge, somebody's worried about it. So it'll be very interesting for us to call the play-by-play on these treasury yields for the next couple months into the summer to see whether or not that comes to fruition. Before we move on to this week's feature interview, we have an announcement. Macro Voices is delighted to announce that our first Macro Voices live event will be held in Toronto on August 10th in 2018. Eric, please tell our listeners more about what we've planned and how people can go about to sign up.
Well, this was by listener request. We had a bunch of emails, and we've decided to go ahead and follow that advice and try this out. So it is Friday, August 10th, Toronto. There will be several speakers. What we've decided to do, you know, we had a lot of conversation. We thought about maybe we should, you know, try to do the biggest event that we could. And we said, you know what? It's our first live event. Let's intentionally make it small and cozy. So we're going to focus on meeting our listeners. And it's going to be a fairly small event at a small venue so that there's time and space available for us to get to know some of you who listen to Macro Voices every week. There's going to be, by design, a meet and greet event afterwards with the speakers. There'll be a cash bar and, you know, a couple hours in the lounge after the event, which will be an opportunity for us to meet you folks and get feedback about the show, what you like about it, what you don't like about it, how we can improve it, and so forth. So it's going to be kind of a small, cozy event. We've got, at this point, Luke Groman, Jeff Snyder, Patrick and myself, as well as Kevin Muir, who writes the Macro Tourist blog, confirmed as speakers. We've got one more slot that we may be able to get a speaker for. We're negotiating on that. I can't say too much more about it. What I can say is we decided to go ahead and book a fairly small venue. It seats 150, so that's going to be our cap for this event. We've decided to not really even try to make a profit on this. We want to cover our expenses for the venue. The price is only going to be $199 Canadian dollars. That's $150 U.S. dollars equivalent, but it's half price for early registration now through July 15th. And if you want to go, I strongly encourage you to take advantage of that early bird special, not just for the discount, but because there's a good chance that we'll sell out and it is a small venue. We don't have more than 150 seats. So that's what we've got for now. We'll have a little bit more conversation and tell you more about what we have planned in the post-game segment after our feature interviews.
Well, thanks, Eric. So let's move on to today's feature interviews. Today we have not one or two, but three feature interview guests. We start off with a short interview featuring Dr. Ellen Wald, whose book, Saudi Inc., has been getting a lot of attention in the oil markets. Then we'll have an in-depth two-guest interview featuring independent and consultant Anas Alhaji and Joe McMonagall, who heads up the energy policy and geopolitics for HedgEye. Eric's interview with Dr. Ellen Wald is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program as our first feature interview guest this week is Dr. Ellen Wald, author of Saudi Inc. Ellen, I think even you have been surprised by how many people are talking about this book. It seems to be on everyone's mind. And I know the approach that you took was to try to explain to your readers, not the outside perspective, but the inside perspective on Saudi Arabia, how they think about the oil market and what they think that things are all about. So please give us the high level. Unfortunately, we don't have time today to go into all of the fantastic detail in your book, but at a high level, how does Saudi Arabia think about the oil market? And particularly, help us understand. So many investors are confused. It feels to us outsiders, like in 2014, they really shot themselves in the foot, basically crashing the oil market, cutting off their own sources of revenue. Was it really an act of incompetence, as some people thought, or do they just see things differently? What's going on?
One of the things when I set out to write this book was that I really wanted people to understand the backstory to that decision in 2014 by Ali Al-Naimi. I would say the most important thing to understand, and that I discuss in my book at length, is that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia has always managed its relationship with Aramco like a family business. And they have two twin perspectives or twin objectives: long-term profit and power. And when they look at Aramco, they're not concerned about meeting, say, what their quarterly reports are going to show or their stock price. They're looking at this in the long term, in a generational perspective. And so in 2014, when it seemed as though, you know, oil production was increasing around the world, there were lots of other sources, not just shale oil production in the United States, but we had really increasing from all over. And they went into that OPEC meeting and everyone thought, oh, they have to cut production. If they don't, they won't maintain the price they need for the budget. And this is what has to be. Instead, they surprised everyone by basically walking out and saying, you know, to heck with it, we're going to produce as much as we possibly can. And the reason, it seemed to me, was very clear. They knew that no matter how low the oil price went, it was going to be that much worse for everybody else and not as bad for Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia had $800 billion in the bank. They could withstand a period of low oil prices for a future with higher oil prices because they were looking in a much longer term, even if it took two or three or even more years. And I think that we're seeing that playing out now.
Now, Saudi Aramco, historically, of course, it was actually founded originally as an American company, but shortly thereafter, it was taken over and nationalized by Saudi Arabia. And it's been, you know, the crown jewels of Saudi Arabia is Saudi Aramco. They've never had an interest before in sharing it with anybody else. So the talk of the IPO of Saudi Aramco, some investors have interpreted as, well, this must be an act of desperation. They must have no choice because we know they don't want to be doing this. And I think that you and other people have expressed a different view that maybe there's more to understand here in terms of the background. So what do you think led up to this IPO discussion, and how serious do you think that they are about being in it for the long haul with the rest of their investors?
I think one of the most important things to understand about Aramco when we're looking at it in this IPO period now is how the Saudis acquired the company from the Americans back in the 70s and 1980. And that's that they bought the company. They actually went out and they negotiated to buy the company in stages. And then even after they bought it, they maintained it as if it was an American company, which in fact it was. It was actually registered in the state of Delaware for 8 years until the Saudis finally recreated it as a Saudi company. And that gives you an idea of how the Saudis have seen their relationship with Aramco. They didn't want to touch it. They knew it was an excellently run company. And when I was there, I had the opportunity to visit Aramco. The people there are incredibly proud of that American heritage. They see their company like Exxon. And in fact, that's really the model that they are striving to work towards as they expand their downstream assets. And they see themselves as a major IOC, not an NOC. And I really think that that is, in essence, where this IPO talk is coming from. You know, it does seem to kind of originate with the Crown Prince and his desires. But in another sense, I see it as this is a natural progression for a company that was an NOC, but has always seen itself as really a major international oil company. And it's expanding its research, it's expanding its downstream operations in order to really have that a profile similar to that of an IOC. They're very, very proud of the patents that they've acquired, and they compare it to the number of patents that, say, Exxon gets. It's really very evident throughout this. So I think that when we're looking at how the IPO is going to take place, we have to look at it kind of in that respect. And it's not entirely the same as an IOC. It is a Saudi company. They've issued a charter that is not really either articles of incorporation or it's kind of like a conglomeration of that. And there are differences. But when we do look at the company and where it's going, we have to understand that they don't see it as just another national oil company. And it isn't really just a national oil company. It's something else entirely.
You mentioned Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. I want to come back to him for just a minute. There were a lot of outside analysts looking in who thought Mohammed bin Salman was crazy at one point. He was talking about his Vision 2030, which was in part to diversify Saudi Arabia's business away from oil into tourism and other things that some outsiders thought was kind of crazy, considering the natural resource that they're sitting on top of. And at the same time, I've heard other people, Marin Katusa particularly on this program, told us that he thinks MBS is perhaps the most brilliant leader in Saudi history, and that he's the guy who really understands how to take the country forward and be successful. So I've heard these just radically diverging views. You've spent much more time really looking at this from the inside out. Tell us your perspective on Mohammed bin Salman. Is he the young prince who doesn't get it, as some have accused, or is he really the genius guy who's going to be the leader that takes the country into the future?
Well, I'm going to come down somewhere in between those two. He's certainly making a break with the previous generations of Saudi leadership. He's a lot more active, especially when it comes to Aramco. The previous kings had really, almost all of them had operated with this idea, which is best expressed in something that Ali al-Naimi said. He had a meeting with the king at one point, and he kind of said, I'm running your oil company, you know, and the king was happy to let them run themselves because they're making a lot of money for the kingdom. Let them do their thing, run it like a business, and the king didn't really interfere very much in it. And Mohammed bin Salman definitely has a different perspective. He's not wrong when he's saying, look, Saudi Arabia needs to diversify its economy, because it may very well be, it is entirely possible that within his reign, because Saudi kings tend to live for a very long time, Saudi Arabia may run out of oil. It's entirely possible. And so he's looking at this through, I think, that kind of a lens. He says, we're not going to stop being an oil producer, and oil and petrochemicals are still going to be a major, major sector of the economy. And in many respects, actually, Vision 2030, Aramco is a participant in it. They see their diversification in bringing in new petrochemical facilities and things like that as them playing a role in Vision 2030. But he's not wrong to try to diversify the economy to bring more Saudis into the workforce. Sometimes I question some of the methods that are very statist. In particular, you know, everything seems to be very much based on money and grants from the state as opposed to encouraging, say, private business, but that may be my American kind of ideas talking. So I would certainly say that he's definitely got a vision and he's pursuing it, and it certainly needed to be done. I do think that maybe in the grand scheme of things, he'll come down somewhere in the middle between a super visionary or complete fool, but he's trying. And there are a lot of people in Saudi Arabia who are very excited by this, and they have national pride in what's going on, and they see a new future. And that may be one of the most important things that he has cultivated, in fact, is this exuberance among the people of Saudi Arabia.
Now, one of the things that is going on with bin Salman's leadership, which is very different, is it seems in many ways like they're kind of modernizing and they're allowing women to drive for the first time. So it seems like they're making progress on a women's right front on one hand. On the other hand, you know, and in as much as I know you were treated very well in your interactions with them, we're hearing recently in the news that women's rights activists in Saudi Arabia will be put to death for the crime of speaking out against what they consider, you know, it's really the same thing as the 1970s women's movement. They're speaking out. We didn't put them to death for that in the 1970s. That's actually being contemplated there. So as a professional woman, how does this come across to you? Because I know they treated you very well, yet other women who are trying to fight for equality are facing a death penalty.
One of the things, and I'll be very, very frank on my feelings about this, you know, I'm an American, and I believe in freedom, and I believe in democracy, and Saudi Arabia is none of those things. You know, I don't like to say, you know, everyone should have our system of government, and people, you know, need to do what they feel is right. But I cannot help but look at that situation and feel this incredible sadness and frustration, because many people are very excited about these new freedoms. And yet at the same time, the message that's coming across from Mohammed bin Salman and from the Saudi leadership is, we, as in the government and the monarch, are the source of all of your freedoms. And, you know, anyone who thinks differently, who says differently, or who expresses, you know, who wants to express their desires is going to be crushed. And that is the message they're sending. And that is incredibly, incredibly sad, because the people that I met and the people there, they want a better future for them and for their children and for their country. And imprisoning these women and the other activists who support them, it's not just their own lives, but they have silenced so many people who supported them, who, you know, tweeted about them, who helped them in any way. Those people are terrified and silenced, and they're losing those voices. And those are the voices of the future. And so it's something that I do feel very, very strongly about. I had a wonderful time when I was there. I think it's a very interesting country. I enjoyed my experience immensely. I would love to go back. But this incident, it should remind us that Saudi Arabia is a monarchy. It is an absolute monarchy, and there are no freedoms there.
Wow. On that note, let's come back to your book, because this has just gotten everyone's attention in the industry. Where is the best place for people to find out more about it? Is there a website, or is it just Amazon? What's the best place?
There is a website. You can go to SaudiInkBook.com and you can learn all about it. You can see some of the reviews that people have posted, some of the different things that people have said about the book from all different perspectives. One of the things that I really tried to do in the book was tell a good story because I wanted it to be entertaining. I wanted it to move. I really wanted to tell an exciting story because there's a lot of excitement in Saudi Arabia. There are a lot of interesting characters you're going to meet, people from long ago and people who are still alive today. And you can definitely find the book on Amazon. It's now available in the United Kingdom as well. You can get it on Amazon US, Amazon UK, and Amazon Canada as well. Also in Barnes & Noble bookstores around the country.
Well, Ellen, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to tell us about the book and about Saudi Arabia. So thanks so much for joining us. Listeners, we'll be back with Anas Al-Haji and Joe McMonagall as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now as our second feature interview are Anas Al-Haji, an independent energy market analyst, and our old friend Joe McMonagall, who of course heads up the Energy Policy and Geopolitics Group at Hedgeye. Both Anas and Joe are must-follows on Twitter, both very prolific and both incredibly knowledgeable about energy markets. Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us. I think the first question on everybody's mind is, what the heck is going on here? It seems to a casual outside observer, like a few weeks ago, Saudi Arabia didn't want higher oil prices, then they did want higher oil prices, now they don't want higher oil prices. There's obviously more to this picture than meets the eye. So what is going on here? What's driving it? Joe, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, sure. I think the main thrust of what's going on now that seems like people are sort of changing their positions is the fact that the market has really, you know, accelerated into a more balanced picture quicker than I think most people thought. One of the main drivers is the very successful OPEC, non-OPEC production cut deal. But the bigger factor here is Venezuela and how quickly Venezuelan crude has come off the market. You know, Venezuela is producing about 1.4 million barrels a day. It's probably 1.3 now in June. Under the OPEC agreement, they could be producing close to 2 million barrels a day. So, you know, that's 600,000, 700,000 barrels extra that has really accelerated crude stock drawdowns and I think has really supported higher prices quicker than most people thought. I was in the camp, and I think others were, that in the second half of this year, we would be around $70, between $70 and $75. Well, obviously, we got there pretty quickly at $80. Most of that had to do with Venezuela. And then, of course, you had the Iran sanctions, which, you know, we've been talking about for a long time that we expected to come. But there were a lot of people in the market that just didn't think Trump would pull the trigger on it. Well, he did. And so that really pushed things up to over $80, although, you know, there isn't any crude yet coming off the market. But we certainly expect that there will be. So I think that's sort of the scene setter. I have to say, I don't think OPEC is going to give up that easy on higher prices. I think the Saudis are quite comfortable with prices around $80. You know, I think they don't really see a production problem. You know, the physical oil markets are pretty well supplied, as I think Anas will talk about, but they really have a small p political problem instead of a p production problem. And the political problem is this, you know, higher prices, you've got some calls for action. You know, Trump, of course, with his tweet a couple of weeks ago while the compliance committee was meeting in Riyadh, I think really took them by surprise. I think there's kind of an implicit agreement to help because of the Iran sanctions. And that's something that Saudi Arabia and UAE and all other Gulf countries support. Then you have, you know, the Indian oil minister or energy minister calling up Khalid Al-Falah to say, you know, we don't like these high prices. You got to do something about it. Then you have Russia, on the other hand, which has really been all throughout the engagement in this production cut alliance, always clamoring to sort of review the agreement, raise production. They're under pretty considerable pressure from the Russian oil companies to increase production and exit the deal. They have major projects coming online that make it difficult for them to stay in the deal. And from the Saudi standpoint, I think they see the coordination with Russia being very critical, at least for the psychological impact on the market. And, you know, you've got the two top producers who have the ability to sort of coordinate market signals. And so they want to keep the Russians in the fold. So they didn't splash cold water all over this proposal from a couple of weeks ago from the Russians to increase production by 1 million barrels a day. But I think they've got a much lower number than I think the Russians do. I saw yesterday the Russians are now promoting, you know, adding 1.8 million barrels back to the market instead of 1 million barrels, basically going back to the pre-production cut levels. I definitely don't think the Saudis are anywhere near that position. That story probably prompted a lot of WhatsApp texting among energy ministers over the last 24 hours. But so that's how I see sort of the big picture of where we are, why we are here today. I'll let Anas offer some insights.
Before we go to Anas, I just want to interject that we do have a slide deck for our listeners. You can find the download link to the slide deck in your Research Roundup email. For any new listeners who are not registered yet, just go to macrovoices.com and click on the red button that says looking for the downloads. Anas, back to you, and feel free to reference your slides in the slide deck.
Yes, Joe is completely correct, especially on Venezuela and Iran. However, it is very clear that the market reacted strongly to what it perceived the Saudi position and the Russian position to be. If we go back and look at every statement that Minister Al-Faleh or Minister Novak basically give to the press or even sometimes privately, we see four key words in all those statements: stability, flexibility, coordinated, and gradual. So anything they are doing right now basically fits those four keywords. So we are talking here about market stability. Market stability requires flexibility. So there is no surprise here on the change in attitude or behavior, because it just fits with what they were saying and what is required from a swing producer. Both of them emphasize the idea of coordinated, which means that they want all OPEC members and everyone else to participate in this decision, even if they cannot participate in terms of increasing production. And of course, it's going to be gradual. And I think this is the most important point here, because if the Saudis decide to increase production, it's going to be really a small increase every month. We are not going to see a major increase in production all of a sudden. We already have seen some in May. Probably we'll see a same level in the coming month. But we also have to remember that we are coming into the summer demand. I'm not only talking about the driving season in the United States. We are talking about the power burn in Saudi Arabia and the rest of the Gulf countries and the rest of OPEC, North Africa, and other places, where demand for crude increases because of the cooling demand that increases with higher temperatures in the summer. So all of these factors together basically indicate that the issue is not that big in terms of the gradual increase in production. So the impact on price is still very limited, and the Saudis still want a higher price. At the same time, we have this higher demand that we have to meet, and some of that demand is domestic demand. Therefore, we have to make a distinction between production and production numbers that OPEC is going to announce later on and net exports. The reason why, because we have large increase in domestic consumption in the summer within OPEC members. And therefore, if they increase production, we want to know what the percentage of it is going to go to exports. And therefore, the impact on prices, even with the increase in production, is really limited.
Why don't we talk next about the Iranian sanctions in particular? It seems like on the 8th of May, when President Trump announced that the United States would pull out of the nuclear deal, that's where we saw the upside breakout beyond the channel resistance line. It seemed like prices were headed to the moon. That lasted for a week or so. And then, of course, we got the messaging out of Saudi Arabia and Russia. It seemed like they wanted to put a stop to that rally. And boy, did they ever. Joe, why don't we start with your perspective? What is the real meaning and consequence? Is the market correctly discounting what the Iranian sanctions are going to mean? And how much does it mean? Because I've heard a lot of conflicting opinions. Some people have said, hey, the reimposition of sanctions on Iran changes everything. It's a complete game changer. Other people have said, look, Iran's going to keep exporting all the oil it wants to. They've got their own ships. They'll sell it to China and other countries and don't care what the United States thinks. Joe, what's your perspective on the consequence and significance of the Iranian sanctions?
I think the market has been really underestimating the impact of Iran sanctions and even Trump's willingness to do Iran sanctions. I mean, leading up to the event, I mean, we talked about this the last time I was on. I've always been very sort of, you know, confident that Trump was going to do this. It was just a matter of timing. And I think, you know, there are still people even now who think that the sanctions aren't going to be implemented as advertised. I mean, I had, you know, one hedge fund guy tell me, oh, this is really just a bumper sticker thing for Trump, you know, to check a campaign box. And it's not really at all. I mean, he's very focused on curtailing oil revenues to Iran. And he's been focused on that for some time. I think that's important. You know, now he's got a different foreign policy team working with him now, too. It's no longer McMaster and Tillerson, who I think were more open to maybe working with the Europeans. It might have been a little bit more flexible with waivers and the implementation of the sanctions. Now he's got Pompeo and John Bolton, who not only agree with Trump on the policy, but I think are going to be much tougher on implementing sanctions. And so the Europeans are trying to keep the deal together, even without the U.S. And the Iranians have kind of given them 2 months. So really, I think till August 1st, to try to keep the benefits of the deal, meaning the oil revenue primarily, but you also have airplane sales, which is another huge issue for the Iranians, and Airbus would certainly be impacted by that as well. You know, the Europeans have got to try to deliver to keep these benefits flowing. If they don't flow, the Iranians are going to probably exit the deal themselves. I think it's very likely they will, and go back to pursuing their nuclear program. At that point, you're going to have the EU have to make a decision whether they're not going to join sanctions or not if that happens. And so I do think there's probably another shoe to drop here, because there's a lot of people who still believe the narrative that, oh, the EU doesn't support it, so the sort of the impact of physical oil being removed from the market is going to be much less. And I think the point here is that governments do not buy the oil. It's the energy companies that buy the oil. So yes, the EU and France and Germany, you know, are opposed to withdrawing from the deal, but Total and Repsol and BP and all these other European companies have big operations in the U.S. And even if they didn't have big economic exposure to the U.S. financial system, and so they've all indicated that, look, unless we get a waiver from sanctions, we're going to comply, and that means we won't be buying Iranian crude. So, you know, Europe alone is about 600,000 to 700,000 barrels a day, depending on the time of year. I think all of that comes off the market. I mean, Iran has added about 1 million barrels to global markets since sanctions were lifted. I actually think the number is closer to 1 million barrels a day. I think consensus is it's probably a lot lower. 300,000, I think, is kind of the consensus number. So I'm a little bit on the other side of that. But, you know, you have South Korea and Japan, who are also big purchasers because of the North Korea situation. I see them complying with U.S. sanctions. The wild cards here are China and India, and both countries have made noise about continuing to cooperate with Iran. The Iranian oil minister traveled to India, and the Indian minister said, we plan to cooperate with Iran in energy, and maybe 4 or 5 days later, the head of Reliance, the big, you know, Indian refiner, said we were not going to be buying Iranian crude anymore because of U.S. sanctions. So the question is, do India and China sop up all this extra oil that would be available? And I don't see that happening. I think China will still be buying oil, but I don't see them increasing their purchases as a result of U.S. sanctions. I think there's a lot of political reasons not to do that. They just certainly, you know, want to stand up to the U.S., but they don't want to poke Trump in the eye either on this. And so I see them sort of maintaining current levels. I don't see them dramatically increasing. So I do see physical oil from Iran coming off the market, and I see it being closer to 1 million barrels a day. You're already seeing companies announce plans to do that. I don't think we'll know for a couple months how much physical oil has come out off. And of course, the sanctions don't actually go into effect until November. So we'll see, I think, an impact later in the year, and it'll be something that OPEC will have to probably address at the November meeting. I don't see them getting ahead of the game on Iran, though. I know there's a lot of speculation that they've got to do something because of Iran's sanctions. I think it'd be very unusual for them to do something in advance of having an impact on the market. And so so I would expect them to maybe address that at the November meeting, not at this June meeting.
Anas, we've got a series of four slides, slides 2 through 5 in the slide deck that you supplied, talking about the significance of what's going on between Iraq and Iran. Please explain.
Yes, I will go to that in a minute. I just want to emphasize the point that when it comes to OPEC members, especially the leaders of OPEC, they really want an increase in oil prices based on fundamentals, not political events. And therefore, we see the possible increase in production from Saudi Arabia and other Gulf allies, simply because they don't want the oil price to be really political, especially in an election year. Generally speaking, I differ with Joe on this. I see that the impact is way lower than 1 million. Like he said, it's probably 300,000 to 400,000 barrels a day, and I'm going to explain why. The impact of the sanctions on Iran is more in the long run, as their investment in upstream basically dwindle and cannibalize the equipment and the spare parts they have. The fact is, the Iranians have perfected their own game under sanctions. If you look at the previous experience and see what they've done, we know for a fact that, yes, their exports declined a little, but not much. And here is why. If you look at the first slide, on the left side, we have Iran's oil production based on secondary sources. That's where companies and shipping companies basically monitor those shipments. And from satellites, they monitor storage and other activities versus what the Iranian government reported to OPEC. And you see at the left side here during the sanctions, you see there is a big gap between the green line and the orange line. At the same time, for the same period, you look on the right side, you look at Iraq, and you see the reverse of that. There is a gap there, and the government numbers basically are way lower than what shippers basically saw as an Iraqi oil coming out of the region. What that means is that means Iran was literally shipping Iranian oil as an Iraqi oil. It's not necessarily that's going through the Iraqi facilities. It just the paperwork of the ships basically is an Iraqi oil as shown in the chart. So some of that crude illegally basically was in the market as an Iraqi oil, but it's really an Iranian oil. And therefore, it cannot be 1 million. It has to be lower than 1 million. And then we have to remember that Iran today has a currency deal with Turkey, with China, and Russia. So they can circumvent the international banking system using local currencies, especially with Turkey and China. They can use gold, as we've seen in the past, and they can use cryptocurrency. So in a sense, we are going to see Iran circumventing those sanctions. Will we see a decline? Yes. How big is it is? In my guess, probably it will be 300,000 to 400,000 barrels a day. That's the actual. However, we might see reporting of 800 or more simply because those reports are not seeing the black market that Iran is using.
Anas, moving on to slide number 3 in the deck, titled Oil Prices Increased at the Start of Disruptions and Then Stabilized. Please explain what's going on here. Why did they stabilize?
Okay. We got out of the financial crisis in 2012 with a very large spare capacity, and we've seen OPEC cut at that time. That made the prices jump from about $35 to about $75. And then the Arab Spring started in February, March 2011, and disruptions increased substantially. And with it, we've seen increase in prices, as we see in this chart. But as you see, that prices peaked at the end of the first quarter of 2013, and then it relatively stabilized around $110, $120, but above $100. The way to explain this is to look at what happened in terms of production and use of spare capacity. So moving to the following slide, really what mitigated prices during the Arab Spring is U.S. shale production. That yellow line is the same slide that just added the additions from the U.S. So that yellow line shows the net additions from shale from the United States. And you can see that it compensated for most of the disruptions that we've seen in 2011, 2012, 2013. So U.S. production basically was a factor. Now we have to remember that we at that time, we did not have U.S. oil exports. Now we are exporting and exports are going up and production continued to go up. So that trend, that yellow line, we are going to see it again once we have more disruptions from Iran and Venezuela. Move to the other slide, basically. And this is a very interesting slide because it plots the same disruptions against the spare capacity. As you can see, that line represents spare capacity. That's the global spare capacity, mostly in OPEC and mostly in Saudi Arabia. With the increase in disruption, the spare capacity declined. And here is the interesting part related to today's events and OPEC meeting next week, that the flexibility of Saudi Arabia and Russia, basically, it just mimic what happened at that time. If we are going to have disruptions, OPEC members are going to use the spare capacity, basically, like they did in 2011 and 2013, and spare capacity will decline. The question is, do we have enough spare capacity? Well, yes, we do. In fact, if you look at the disruption, at the peak of that disruption, you see it's about 3.6 million barrels a day at that time. And spare capacity was about 6 million, and then it declined to about 3 million. So at the peak of the crisis, spare capacity was around 2.8 million, but the disruption was about 3.6 million. Right now, the disruption is only 1.6 million, and according to the IEA, the spare capacity is about 3.6 million. Now, if you don't believe in it, just take off 1 million out of it. Probably we have about 2.6 million. But based on market fundamentals, we are way better off than where we were in 2012, 2013, simply because we still have about 150 million barrels in commercial storage that is above the level we had in 2014 and before. We still can use the SPR. We can release 1.5, 2 million barrels a day of SPR for at least 3 months without any problems. And then we have the flexibility of OPEC members basically to produce more. So it's very hard to see a crisis similar to what we had in 2012, 2013. And therefore, it's very hard to see prices above $100, even with the loss of Venezuelan and Iranian oil.
Let's talk next about the range of possibility for what might happen going into next week's OPEC meeting. I've heard every perspective possible, ranging from people saying, look, the writing's on the wall. Saudi Arabia and Russia both want higher production. They're going to completely nix the production cuts. That's going to be canceled over and done with, and it's going to be a free-for-all from here. Other people are saying the exact opposite, which is, no, it's not a done deal at all. They were just messaging things to kind of get the froth out of the market. It's very likely that we'll see a continuation now that they've adjusted the market as they wanted to. They probably won't change anything. Joe, why don't we go back to you for your perspective first? What do you think the range of possibility is for next week's OPEC meeting?
Yeah, I mean, I think as I said when we opened, I really see a more modest production increase, not the million barrels that the Russians floated in St. Petersburg, and certainly not the 1.8 million barrels that they floated this week. And so I see something more symbolic coming out of this OPEC meeting, notwithstanding the fact that, you know, a lot of OPEC countries in particular, I'm not talking about the non-OPEC, which is probably all, most of them are probably clamoring to increase production, but really the OPEC members themselves are probably not very supportive of doing something that's going to depress prices. So we're already seeing disagreements. Some of it's political, with Iran saying that they didn't want to see any kind of unilateral action. The Iraqi minister, you know, basically said that ministers should not be exaggerating the need for more oil, and also said they didn't support unilateral action, almost, you know, echoing the exact messaging from Iran. But you have other countries, Nigeria and others, who are going to be, Algeria will be opposed to increasing production. And I really don't think the Saudis want to do it, but I think they feel like they have political issues they have to address. Now, as Anas pointed out, you know, they've already raised production by about 200,000 barrels, but it's really to meet summer domestic demand for energy. So they've already raised, but, you know, it's being used, I think, to say, oh, no, we're interested in increasing production. So it conveniently allows them to have some dual messaging, but it's something that they probably would have done anyway. I guess the bottom line is, I don't think that there's an option for no action or maintaining sort of the status quo at this meeting, but certainly not a million barrels a day. And after that messaging in St. Petersburg at that conference that both the Saudi and Russian ministers spoke at, that's when you had the sharp drop in oil prices based on a million barrels a day. So anything short of a million barrels, I think, is probably bullish for oil prices. Even if they do 500,000, which I think would be the high end of any kind of move, as Anas pointed out, you've got, probably Venezuela, you've got another 500,000 barrels coming off the market there. By the end of the year, we're going to see some impact on Iran. You know, we obviously disagree on how much, but even if it's not a million, it's 500,000, that's another million barrels. So even if OPEC adds production, I think it's going to be pretty bullish for oil prices. And just to quickly hit on the spare capacity issue, I think the EIA number for 2018 is just below 2 million barrels a day for OPEC surplus crude oil capacity, at least according to the latest short-term energy outlook. You know, so if you add production now, you know, that number is going to narrow, go down, which is, you know, it's sort of a mixed message to the market, I think, in terms of, you know, whether it's adding production is bullish or bearish. I think that's something to keep in mind. The EIA is forecasting spare production capacity for OPEC at about 1 million barrels in 2019. So that's becoming tighter and tighter. And if you do have some big geopolitical event, you don't have a lot of cushion there, although you do have the strategic petroleum reserve and of course, some IEA action. But that's really last resort type activity that you would see. So I think the market's going to be concerned about spare capacity decreasing as we move forward.
Anas, what's your take on potential outcomes from the OPEC meeting?
Sure. Generally speaking, it is very clear that the Saudis want a complete success of the agreement. A complete success of the agreement requires certain steps, and of course, flexibility is part of it. So the expectation basically is to maintain the agreement, and it is very clear that all members want to maintain the agreement. So there is no end to the agreement, even by the end of 2018, but we are going to end up with lower compliance. The issue here is, what is lower compliance? And I think that's where most of the discussions are going to be. And the best way to explain it is this. We have a ceiling, and you can lower compliance by either lowering the ceiling or increase production. Remember that historically, OPEC made decisions to legitimize existing cheating. In a sense, what they did is they raised the ceiling to match the production. Now we might see the opposite, basically, where they want to maintain the idea and the appearance that the agreement is working by showing a very large compliance despite the increase in the production over summer. So we might end up with people calling for lower ceilings. So that 1.8 is going to be, the 1.8 cut is going to be lowered while we see higher production, and therefore we are at 100% any way you look at it. Or we maintain the 1.8 cut, but we increase production basically to compensate for Venezuela and others and maintain 100% cut. So the bottom line is maintain the agreement with lower compliance. The language could be surprising that they are going to come up with because they've done this in the past. I just would like to comment on the 1 million barrel out of Pittsburgh, that the one that mentioned earlier about the 1 million barrel possible increase in production. There was no mention of time frame. And we also heard from them that they will increase production if needed. Those two words were dropped from several media stories. So in a sense, like Joe said, it's going to be a gradual increase, but not a big one. And it is very clear that we might end up with 1 million, but over a longer period of time.
Let's broaden this conversation out now to the bigger, longer-term picture. Some people are saying that we are at a crossroads in history here where the U.S. dollar is losing its prominence as the global reserve currency. The Shanghai yuan-denominated oil contract is certainly evidence that there are efforts afoot by some countries trying to displace the dollar as the standard of oil commerce. I've heard other people say, look, this is nothing more than a symbolic gesture that's meaningless and it doesn't change anything. If we look at the big picture of Saudi Arabia, its relationships with Russia, which is becoming so much more important in recent years, China, and also, you know, what the heck is going to be the future of Venezuela, because that is a hugely, hugely important oil producer in terms of its potential. Even though they're only producing a little over a million barrels a day now, that country could produce 4 million barrels if the government had their act together. So at some point, I would hope that that's and come back online if we see a new regime in Venezuela. What's your long-term outlook for the geopolitical interactions, and what are the most important things for investors to be paying attention to as this geopolitical story unfolds? Joe, why don't we start with you again?
Yeah, sure. I think we're yet to see really the potential, if there is potential for the, you know, alternative currency models for oil prices, but it's definitely something to keep an eye on. And maybe as sanctions get implemented, maybe we start to test whether there will be more expanded use of alternatives to the U.S. dollar. I think you hit the main focus, I think, for oil markets. Venezuela is kind of the key driver. It's creating so much geopolitical risk in the market now. It's really, as I said, accelerated the fundamentals to increase prices and have accelerated drawdowns in crude stocks. Our forecast is, you know, it's basically another 500,000 barrels by the end of the year, based on that this year they've been losing about 50,000 barrels per day per month. And I think there is a risk now that the country could totally go into chaos, and you wouldn't just lose another 500,000, you could lose all of it. And that would be obviously a big issue for oil prices. Also, because the sort of the global refining sector is very sort of dependent on the medium to heavier crudes. It's not really the light crudes that the U.S. is producing here. So if you had a big heavy crude producer go down like Venezuela, it would have major implications for the market. But I think also, as you point out, it has tremendous capability. I mean, that country, it's such a shame that the oil riches that they have and the conditions in that country now are just horrible. And I was just in Colombia this past week, and there are tons and tons of Venezuelan immigrants in that country. And it's just so sad to see. But, if there is some kind of political change and you could have a new government, I don't think it would take long for them to increase production. I mean, part of the reason the production has gone down is the army is kind of in control now of production, and you just don't have as many rigs operating right now. So I think if you had a new government that was at least more competent, you could see that production rise quite quickly. And of course, that would have the opposite impact on the market. So I think Venezuela is kind of the key driver here. Non-OPEC production is forecast to rise, I think, over 2019. So I think, you know, you could see the call on OPEC oil actually be lower in 2019. So I think that's another reason why OPEC may not want to get ahead of itself here and prematurely raise production until they see, you know, what the market conditions are.
Anas, what's your take?
Generally speaking, when we talk about the yuan dominated contract in China, we have to distinguish between pricing in dollar and getting revenues in dollar. All we are seeing here basically is we are seeing a price in China that is highly correlated with other prices. So the pricing remains in dollar. There is no independent pricing in yuan. And I think this is going to continue. No matter what, oil will be priced in dollar, but we might see revenues collected in other currencies like we've seen historically with Iraq, Iran, and other countries like Venezuela now. However, we have to emphasize the role of exchange rates and the role of the appreciating dollar today in the Saudi decision and the Russian decision to increase output, if they increase it, of course, officially in the next meeting. Simply because, aside from the political issues, the most important factor impacting demand right now around the world is the appreciating dollar. Simply because it's making fuel more expensive in various places around the world. Looking at India specifically, since India was mentioned several times on this show, the reason for the increase in India or why India is really worried about the impact of higher oil prices has nothing to do with OPEC and the increase in oil prices. It's really the taxation, the heavy taxation of petroleum products since 2014. I think they increased taxes five times in only 4 years on petroleum products. If they are really serious about mitigating the impact of high oil prices, they should lower taxes. They can use fiscal and monetary policy to mitigate that, as they've done in 2006, 2007, and early 2008. But the higher dollar is not helping them. Every time the dollar increases, they get more pain in India. So the bottom line here, exchange rates matter no matter what.
Gentlemen, what I'd like to do next is go back to our slide deck, looking at page number 6. I've got a chart here of continuous contract front month WTI crude oil prices. And I apologize, listeners, for the noise in this chart. There's every moving average known to man shown in this chart. For purposes of our conversation, we don't really care about that. What we care about is the purple channel, which you see, the two parallel lines where the price has mostly been moving between them. And the dotted orange vertical line indicates the point at which Donald Trump made the announcement that the United States would pull out of the Iran nuclear deal. And what we see is after that announcement, we see prices break out above that purple resistance line. We're kind of hugging along on the top of the line there. It seems like maybe we're getting ready for an upside breakout, and that's the point where Russia and Saudi Arabia decide to, at least for a while, put a blanket over this party and make their announcement that they're both considering increasing production. That's where we see the collapse about 10 days after President Trump's announcement, where front month prices fall all the way down below the lower support line, the lower purple line, and now they're just hugging the line there. It feels to me, if I look at this chart in isolation, it seems like, boy, we're hugging along on the bottom of that channel support line. Maybe we're about to climb back up into the channel. Maybe the market's just waiting for confirmation from the OPEC meeting, and we're headed higher, is the sense I get from this. But the thing is, a lot of people, a lot of analysts consider backwardation as a very strong leading indicator of what's going to happen next in front month prices. So if we move on to slide number 7, and I really want to give credit where it's due, because Anas, I think it was the day of the president's announcement about pulling out of the Iran deal, Anas tweeted saying backwardation is going to be much less. And quite a few people, myself included, responded to that saying, Anas, what are you talking about? Backwardation normally indicates tightness in the market. Iran coming offline because of sanctions can only mean more tightness. It shouldn't mean less backwardation. It should be more backwardation. And Anas very confidently replied and said, no, guys, look, this business about leaving the Iran deal was priced into the front of the curve, but not the back of the curve. And what you're going to see next is the back of the curve is going to adjust, and that's going to result in a reduction of backwardation. Well, holy cow, Anas, I really got to hand it to you. Look at just 2 days after you said that, This chart on page 7 is showing us backwardation. This specifically is the degree of backwardation in 2019. It's a measure of the difference between the December 2018 delivery contract and the December 2019 delivery contract. Now, on this chart, we go through that lower support line, but we don't stop there. The price has outright collapsed down to that lower orange line is the 200-day moving average. And it looks like it's consolidating there and trying to decide what to do next. So this really, to my mind, begs a question, which is if backwardation is often a sign of what could be coming next in front-month prices, this chart, if I look at it without considering any other factors, seems like it is predicting an outright collapse of oil prices. So I want to get your perspective on that. Before I do, I think in the interest of time, we're not going to be able to get into all of these charts. Moving on to slide 8, for any listeners who aren't familiar with this concept of backwardation, backwardation refers to each successive delivery month contract. So each of these yellow dots that you see depicted on slide number 8 is the price of oil in a different delivery month. The first one is July of 2018, then August, then September, then October, and so forth. And this chart goes all the way out to 2026. What we're seeing is this downsloping condition of lower prices over time is called backwardation. The light yellow in the background there, that's what the curve looked like back on the 10th of May, just before everything. It was 2 days after President Trump's announcement. There was a very steep backwardation, higher front month prices, lower long dated prices. What we've seen in the last month from the 10th of May to the 11th of June, the 11th of June is the brighter yellow color. We've seen not only has the front month price dropped dramatically, but normally we would expect if the front month price goes down dramatically, we'd expect the back month prices to go down in sympathy. They went the opposite direction. Back month prices are going up even as front month prices are going down. So as Anas predicted so presciently, what's happening here is the market is discounting in the effect of the Iran sanctions and causing those longer dated prices to move higher. That's depicted also on slide number 9. What you see here is the bar chart is the front month futures contract in a continuous contract format. Then all of the other lines below it are individual contracts going all the way out to 2024, showing us what each of those contracts did. And you see those very steep increases in price right after the Iran nuclear announcement are so steep at the back of the curve. It's because just as Anas predicted, the long-dated prices are adjusting dramatically upward in reaction to the Iran announcement, even as in some cases, the near-dated prices are moving down at the same time. I'm going to save the rest of the deck for now. We'll come back to that later. But I want to go back to slides 6 and 7 because you guys are both experts on this. I think there's more to the equation than just backwardation. If I look at this dichotomy, slide 6 suggests to me like, hey, the price is maybe about to recover to the upside. Slide 7 seems to predict, if you believe backwardation is a predictor, that prices are about to crash. How do you guys see this? Where do you think that front month price is headed? And where do you think that this trend in backwardation is headed? Joe, why don't we start with you again?
Yeah, sure. Well, I don't see a crash coming. I mean, I think there's just so many fundamental factors pointing to increased demand and so many geopolitical events, removing physical oil from the market, that we're about to enter, I think, a very tight oil supply demand phase. The other factor here is, you know, that we haven't really talked about is there hasn't really been a lot of capital investment in new supply, mainly because prices until the last couple months have been kind of depressed. And so I think companies are now thinking about some of these capital investment projects. I think we need to see some big offshore mega project type investments. I mean, there are a few oddballs, you know, throughout the world, but you haven't really seen Exxon or any of the big oil majors announce some big projects. And then until we start seeing more investment in further supply, I think we're going to be in a period here where, you know, oil prices are going to be tight because of supply demand picture, and absent some kind of recession, you know, I don't see any kind of relief coming here. I think prices are heading higher. I don't see them heading lower in the near term.
Anas, let's go to you. Why don't we start with front month prices on page 6? Where do you see things headed from here?
Sure. Eric, if people want to know the importance of OPEC meeting next week, they should look at your 2 slides and your explanation of them and how one of them tell that prices are going up, the other one is going down. This is really what the significance of this OPEC meeting is. It is a very significant meeting because it is going to determine whether prices will go back to that channel or they are going to decline. Probably by now you are already aware of President Trump's second tweet about OPEC. And I think that means the political pressure is still on. And we will see how OPEC officials are going to respond to his tweet today. But it is very clear that we are in an election year in the United States. No party and no president basically wants higher gasoline prices, and they want to give at least lip service to the voters. How would OPEC react to that is going to determine really what's going to happen to the front month. I like what Joe said, that the reaction is going to be mild. It is part of the policy to have a gradual increase in production. They can satisfy Trump on one side and satisfy their needs on the other. So the idea of prices collapsing basically is not in the picture right now. But at the same time, it's very hard to see kind of a large increase immediately. But once we come to July and August, I think we are going to have a completely different picture. The whole chart basically is going to look different by then, simply because we have the domestic demand in the oil-producing countries, usually in the summer. At the same time, what people ignore is the fact that those oil-producing countries have extra money for the first time in about 3 years. And that's going to show. So we have more economic activities in those countries. So between the weather and the economic activities, we are going to see higher domestic demand in those countries. And it is very hard to see a decline in prices.
And since you so brilliantly called this collapse in backwardation, which began on the 10th of May, what do you see from here? Is this ending? Is it got further to go? Is the 200-day moving average that we see as the yellow or gold-colored line at the bottom of page 7, is that going to contain it? Or do you think that maybe we've got further to go?
Well, it all depends if we are going to have a big political surprise or not. And that's really an issue. Of course, we have Venezuela. We don't know what's going to happen. Now, we predict a decline in production of Venezuela. But what about unpredicted? And that's where the issues are for Iran. What if really, if there is something cooking for Iran? In a sense, what if all this increase in production is really coordinated because there are more than sanctions and even more stringent policy toward Iran than what even Joe mentioned earlier? So it is really those surprising political events are going to determine that. A big surprise is going to make backwardation probably worse than before.
Okay, so potentially it goes to higher than it was before. And without surprise, do you think it stays where it is? Do you think it can collapse further? What's the other side of the coin?
I think the curve is going to flatten, especially once we know what is the impact of the sanctions and what's going to happen by that time, because people will start reacting to the long term by that time rather than just the front month.
Okay, so a continued flattening of the curve in absence of geopolitical surprise and potentially a return to even greater backwardation than we saw at the peak in the event of that geopolitical surprise. So it's very much dependent in your eyes on where the geopolitics take us next.
Correct.
Fantastic. Well, gentlemen, I can't thank you both enough for a fantastic interview. In the interest of time, we're going to have to leave off the end of the slide deck for our listeners' benefit. What's there starting at slide 10 is I've just broken out this trend in backwardation by year on slide 10, then slide 11, I take it into 6-month intervals, and then quarterly, and eventually we get down to monthly on the final slide. And it's very interesting to see how how the various geopolitical events, the Iran announcement, have been turning points and some kind of mysterious behavior on a couple of months. Particularly, I'll just ask you this, Anas. If you look at slide 14 in the deck, we see that the September-October of 18 and also the August to September of 18, those two monthly contracts seem to have just completely departed from the rest of the pack, and they're off on their own, rebounding dramatically, almost as if the market is expecting some tightness event immediately after the OPEC meeting. Any insight on what might be going on there?
Well, generally speaking, there was many media reports talking about the collapse of the meeting. They are talking about the collapse of the agreement. The Russians had a statement like a few hours before the meeting indicating that the possibility of the collapse of the agreement. And then the result was exactly the opposite.
Okay, so it sounds like you think that these changes that we're seeing in the term structure are reactions to the news flow about what may be happening in next week's meeting. We're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time. Before we go, though, I want to give each of you a chance. For people who want to follow your work, what's the best way for them to do so? Joe, let's start with you.
I'm on Twitter, so at Joe McMonagle is my Twitter handle. And of course, if you're a subscriber of HedgeEye, all my stuff is available there. I'm occasionally on the Macro Show that I think a lot of your viewers know, that's hosted by Keith McCullough. And we talk about OPEC and oil prices quite a bit because it's really, as you know, part of the big macro picture.
And Anas?
Twitter account, Anas Alhaji, and you can find that at Anas Alhaji, which you can find it on the chart that I posted earlier. Although my website, anasalhaji.com, there are many what I call timeless articles you can pull at any time, and they can look like they've been written yesterday.
Okay. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for a fantastic interview. Patrick Serezna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Eric, what a great set of interviews. We first heard this story about Saudi Arabia from Marin Katusa when we had him on the show in December. And what I find really interesting is that we often fall into the trap of looking at the world through the lenses of the Western world capitalism. Clearly, one has to approach this from a much bigger picture perspective when we hear the way things work over there. What was your takeaway from the interviews?
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And, Alan went and actually traveled to Saudi Arabia, visited Aramco, visited with the various different people, met all kinds of fascinating people there, and really did her research boots on the ground. And similarly, for this interview, we were taping Joe McMonagle from his office in Washington, D.C., but Anas Alhaji was actually in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, when we taped the interview. Again, boots on the ground perspective on how things work there is just so important to understand, because it's just such a radically different culture. And it's not just the national culture, but it's the business culture and the way people think that is dramatically different. So unfortunately, we had so much excellent conversation about that we didn't really get into my term structure charts, which I was really looking forward to talking to Anas and Joe about. We went ahead and left those extra charts in the download PowerPoint deck just for our listeners who might be curious. We didn't really get to discuss it, but for some reason, for the last few days, boy, the front end of the WTI futures curve, those time spreads are just blowing out with an explosion of backwardation at the front of the curve, even as the back of the curve stays very subdued. So this may be an indication that backwardation is bottoming, as we talked to Anas about. We'll see what happens, but definitely something is afoot here.
Now, Eric, I want to get back to our live event in Toronto coming up in August, you know, and I'm so looking forward to this event. You know, when we planted the seed about doing this a couple of weeks ago, I mean, this is a short notice to put together a show, and I'm just so excited about it. I think the part that I am most excited about is the fact that we're going to have this reception meet and greet afterwards where we can have a cocktail with our listeners. We can find out what they like and don't like about the show, what guests they want to see in the future, all sorts of fun interaction. I think it's going to be a great time. What are you looking forward to?
Well, I'm very much looking forward to it. Let's share with our listeners what we have intended as a format. Basically, it's going to be a number of speakers, probably 45 to 50 minute presentations with a 10 minute break in between. Then the last session of the day is going to be a panel, and this was based on feedback we got from the survey that we sent out. It's going to be a panel of all the speakers, both asking one another questions and also taking questions from the audience. We put a lot of effort into finding just the right venue for this. We found a nice cozy setting. It only holds 150 people, but right outside of the presentation room, there's a big lobby where they're going to set a cash bar up for us after the event. We decided, in order to keep this event cheap, to kind of go no frills. If you look at the usual event where, you know, there's coffee and Danish in the beginning, they charge like $15 to $20 per person that you have to pay the hotel to provide that service. And we just didn't want to encumber everybody with a $500 event. So at $75 at the early bird special price, it's no frills. You're going to have to buy your own lunch and it's a cash bar afterwards. But we've designed it so that we'll be available to meet you and get a chance to talk to you, learn about what you think about the show, any ideas that you have for how we might improve it, and so forth. So it's going to be kind of a small family-style event for our first one. We'll see how this goes. If it's popular, we'll consider doing larger events in the future. But we wanted to start small and just see where it takes us. Your Research Roundup email has a link to the landing page for registration. If you don't have a Research Roundup email and haven't registered yet, just go to macrovoices.com. You should find a link there that will get you there. I really want to emphasize, though, folks, if you want to go to this event, be sure to register early because it is a small venue. We don't know yet whether we're going to go with the list of speakers that we've already told you about or if we're going to be able to add one more to the agenda. In the meantime, sign up now if you can because it is a very small venue and that's a conscious decision we made because we wanted this event to be small enough to give us time to actually get a chance to talk to you, our listeners, and learn more about your desires and so forth. So if you're excited to go to this, I know it sounds like a sales pitch, but it's really not. Move fast because I do see a significant risk of a sellout for this event. In any case, we are out of time, so we're going to leave it there. We do need your help promoting Macro Voices, so please share your Research Roundup emails, forward them to your friends and colleagues, and most importantly, if you haven't done so yet, shame, shame, go to macrovoices.com and register your free account. The benefit to you is that you'll receive our free Research Roundup email each week, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It's just a compendium of links to all of the coolest stuff that we could find, such as the slide deck that we had for you for the interview with Hannes and Joe today, as well as any other cool research that we could find on the internet each week. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
So this week in the Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as the link to the chart book that Eric, Hannes, and Joe were referencing during the interview. Also, the article that I referenced at the beginning about the $75 million options bet on those 10-year yields, the link for that article is in the Roundup as well. A link to the Bank of Canada Financial System Review, which in my mind is a semi-annual must-read. I also included a link to the Variant Perception blog, which they had a really interesting piece on yield curve inversion and will it happen before the next recession. And I thought it was really interesting because one of my ideas is that we may very well not see a yield curve inversion this time around before a recession. And it's really interesting the way that they've compiled the ideas around that. Nonetheless, you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners. And we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup at macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.